Alright, good evening, happy new year everyone. How's the volume? Anyone having trouble hearing? If you have trouble hearing, we do have some hearing assistive devices in the back. It looks like there's still a few back there that you're welcome to use. So I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about this year's theme that we'll be using on Monday nights and also on Sundays, and a little bit about the other offerings that we'll be having coming down the calendar. So this year, Tori and I decided to talk about dependent origination. So dependent origination is something I can hear you, some of you excited, some of you are like, what is that? On the back of this card that Tori lovingly developed, it says, whoever sees dependent origination sees the Dharma. Whoever sees the Dharma sees dependent origination. And whoever sees the Dharma sees the Buddha. So it's a very fundamental teaching of the Buddha. It's complex. It has 12 different stages or cycles that are really linked together. We can look at it as past conditions, present conditions, future effects, past effects. There's all this complexity to it. But it boils down much to understanding this creation of a sense of self, the sense of how do we create the me and mine. How does that actually happen? And how the past has this power to predispose us to seeing life in a certain way, to hearing a thing, a sound, and liking it or disliking it, a smell, even a reaction. This is the basis for all the prejudice that we have, all the biases that we have, kind of presets us to experience the moment in a particular way. Dependent origination reveals how that is done. And then once that moment is kind of preset, we have some sense data. We see another person. We have a thought, an emotion. And that can quickly go into this quality of moving toward it with gripping, with craving, with clinging, going into a sense of becoming and becoming birthed. Now, birth seems like that's a good thing in our society, right? It's good to be born and to kind of come into a sense of self. But in the Dharma, we also look at the self and its drawbacks and how that sense of self creates a level of isolation and separation that we spend, actually, if you look deeply, most of our lives trying to overcome. We're trying to find that sense of connection, that sense of unity that seems always far away because we don't realize it's the very premise that we based our lives upon. And so in this way, dependent origination explores this whole mechanism that comes together to create this sense of I, of me, of mine, this sense of other, of you, of the other person, whether we like that person or dislike that person. That all creates it's a very intricate mechanism. So we're looking forward. I was working on a few notes for this, and I had to stop myself because I was trying to write a 40-minute talk. I only have 10 minutes to talk about this. So there's a lot of enthusiasm, you know, and on our parts to explore this. And you just spent last year's intensive exploring this. Yeah, so it's a very deep teaching. And that sense of self, that creation of self, is linked to why we suffer. We have a sense of self, we will eventually have suffering that arises from it. Sometimes it's in the middle of that selfing, the midst of a difficult emotion, a thought storm that's reactive. And sometimes it's when that pleasant state fades, when it no longer stays. That's when the suffering arises. And so it ties us to this cycle of suffering, of rebirth and death and suffering. In rebirth, we can look at it just in this lifetime, even in this moment, countless times that we take birth and have experienced suffering in some way. So we're hoping that this exploration, we can really stretch out, taking each cycle of the 12 steps each month, and start to get very much more in tune with it, much more experiential with it as we go through. So I could say a lot more about it, but we want to also touch in upon this year's, some of the teaching things are coming up. We actually have quite a full calendar. Just on a weekly or monthly basis, we'll have Monday nights here. We'll be Sundays every week. There'll be Thursday morning sits. And every week there's a Thursday evening sit, Capitol Hill. Every other week there'll be a meeting over at in East Side in Kirkland. There'll also be a meeting for the under 40 will start up this month too, every other week, I believe. And so there's many opportunities to sit with others, to practice, to engage in the Dharma. We also will be offering a number of intro classes for people who want to have a refresher in the meditation techniques or just want to learn how to do it more clearly. Offering one starting next week, actually, here on Thursdays and then the East Side on Wednesdays for 6 weeks. We'll be offering four of those this year. The local Dharma leaders will be offering another class coming up, and then you're offering another intensive, right? So kind of covering the whole spectrum from beginner to very experienced, to hopefully feed everyone's needs in the Dharma. Also, we'll have a number of visiting teachers. Rodney Smith, the founder of SIMS, will be coming on the 18th and 19th. Then we have the Venerable Panawati in March 6th and 8th. Narayan will be coming on in April. Norman Fisher in May. Tori is going to be offering a Nine Bodies retreat in June. And Carol Wilson will be coming in October. For those, this will be Carol's first year here, and she's a dear colleague of Rodney's, one of the guiding teachers at IMS, and a very experienced teacher for probably 30 years at least of practice. And finally, Philip Moffitt in December. So it'll hopefully be a very fulfilling year of Dharma for you and help you feel nourished as we deepen the Dharma together. All right, thank you.
Tim had 10 minutes, and he didn't really need this clock because he's on time. I have a short window. I'm going to try to stay on time. But I want to talk about something a little different. We're still going to talk about the refuges and precepts. Tim is going to talk about that. So I think of it as Tim is talking about the wisdom side of practice, and I really want to talk about the heart side. I don't know if it's because I miss us so much being gone, assisting on all these retreats, or just the sure fear that I have about where we are in the world. You know, I mean, I don't know if you've seen some of the pictures of Australia, but man, that is apocalyptic level understanding that we have to come into. And if you haven't seen it, the sky is orange, it's red. And I saw this little video, the slow motion across the country of Australia, where all these fires are. And it just said one little line, it just said that the little white dots represent where there's an active fire going. And then it starts spanning across the country from a satellite. And at first you see, you know, like, okay, like, we're like California, you know, like a lot of fires. Okay, I see it. But it just like keeps going. It is stunning how terrifying it is. Even the flooding, the level of violence against trans people and people of color and Jewish people, it is rocking my foundation. And I'm a pretty optimistic person, but if it's rocking my foundation, I know it's rocking a lot of people's foundation. So I thought I would start this conversation with a little bit of a poem here by Alberto Rios, who says, "We are of a tribe. We plant seeds in the ground and dreams in the sky. hoping that someday the roots of one will meet the upstretched limbs of the other. It has not happened yet. We share the sky, all of us, the whole world, together. We are a tribe of eyes that look upward, even as we stand on uncertain ground. The earth beneath us moves, quiet and wild, its boundaries shifting, its muscles wavering. The dream of sky is indifferent to all of this, impervious to borders, fences, and reservations. The sky is our common home, the place where we live. There we are in the world together. The dream of sky requires no passport. Blue will not be fenced. Blue will not be a crime. Look up. Stay a while. Let your breathing slow. Know that you always have a home here. I think that's what I am thinking about when I'm gone all the time. This idea of home here, home here, home here. And I want to share a little bit about some things that are kind of, they're not difficult to talk about, but there's a realness that we have to sort of begin to have with each other about how it is that we have this home here. Because I think this is the first space completely away from Rodney. We've always been kind of connected to Rodney in this very held way. And when we left Soto, we came here to this space. And this is the first space without Rodney. The first time we're kind of like, it's almost like when you're moving out of your parents' house. It's got that feel to it, you know. Are we going to make it? Are we going to be able to pull it off? Do I have to go back home? Really don't want that to happen. But there's some things that I think, Tim and I talked about this, and I'm the one that's going to share it, but there's some things that we need to begin to bring together in a realistic way in order for us to hold ourselves together through these very difficult times. Because I do not see that the times are going to get easier. I think they're going to get more and more and more difficult. With all the rumors of war and just the violence and anger that's around, it's going to get difficult. And so there's a way in which it's not a cocoon away from the world. It is the stability that allows us to walk in the world. That's what it is. So I think of this as Buddha's way. If I think of Buddha's way, what Buddha did at a time when when the world was violent, similar to the world we have, he awoke in that world, had this awakening kind of wisdom. And he could have taken that wisdom and just freed his own mind so he could just go about his business, do whatever he wanted to do. But he did not. He turned that wisdom into a practice for people that followed him, people who walked his path, followed his teachings towards enlightenment, and the connection that he made with the community. So what Buddha did is that he took what he learned and gave it freely to everybody, anybody. He had his monastics give it to anybody. You came up and asked for it, It's yours. Let me give it to you. I'm going to take the time to help you go through this practice, to learn this practice of mindfulness and meditation, to stay on the path, to work with all the difficulties that arise. I read this piece one time that many of the monks that joined Buddha's order, even for many, many years after Buddha had died, came from very meager lives. Very meager, almost nothing lives. Rural people. People who had to leave their family and go into the monk's world, and that meant that somebody wasn't going to be out there working because they were going to go on this monastic journey. So how is it that Asia held together this practice so long, so deep, that it would travel all the way into the West in a completely different culture and still take root here? How is it that they did that? And it is because the Buddha brought generosity into his practice. It is not about gaining something. It's about giving something. So he created a practice that inherent within it, the monastics had to give to all these villagers, and all these villagers had to give to the monastics. That they were intertwined so much together that they had to depend on each other. There is something about depending on each other. Not just can you come to Sims, but do you depend on Sims? Not just do we have enough dana, but do we depend on the Sangha to give that dana? And there's a way in which I think, you know, to be honest, when we did not move into our own building, I was like, it took a long time and a whole bunch of practice for me to settle into that reality that we were going to leave a dedicated space and go into a rented space. We were going to leave a huge parking lot and go into street parking again, sort of like when we were at Beth Shalom. It took a lot, or even Keystone was worse. It took a lot for me to practice with that, because I had this expectation of what it is that I wanted. But the more I thought about it, the more I began to understand something here. So we are in difficult times, and we have to practice in difficult times. And so what that means is the same irritation you have trying to find a parking space is the same irritation you have about the politics that may or may not be happening in the country. It's the same irritation. It's just irritation. There's a way in which being generous in your dana, meaning that you give to Sims every week, every month, all year, in this sense of giving, is the same reality that we, it goes against this idea that there's not enough. We got to be careful. There's not going to be enough. Something's going to go wrong. There's some way in which the Buddha took people who came from nothing and not much and gave them permission to give against the backdrop of a thought that there won't be enough. Something happens when we start getting generous against the backdrop of an idea that there's not going to be enough. We, as a Sangha, need to go against the stream of the world right now. And we need to be intentional about that going against the stream. It's not just giving dana, though. It is giving money. I don't want to give you the impression that we don't need it, because we definitely need everybody here to give financially for us, because we are also now in a world where we have to pay rent everywhere. We can't just say, oh, we're just going to have that non-residential and there's no, you know, we'll just have it here. It's not like that. If we go to Bastyr, we're going to pay Bastyr in order to be there. So there is a stronger sense that we all have to give in order for this to be, to work its way out. But it's not just giving money. Some things, I'm taking some of this from Asian culture because part of the reason why the Dhamma came to us is because of the way it was held in Asia. So families would give a day of service, a month of service, a year of service to their monastery as part of their life. It's not this idea of, I owe my life to my synagogue, my church, my temple. It's not that. It is giving of service, and the place that you gave your service was at the monastery, because if you did not give that service, it wouldn't happen. So there's a sense that you're giving service not because you're a part of some religious understanding. You're giving service because it's a need. So I wonder sometimes what it would look like if Sims, if everybody that was part of Sims figured out some way to give up service, and then everybody was giving service. If we just came and gave service once a month, or gave service once for one non-residential, or one day of mindfulness, one beginner's class. It's not like it's going to be easy to do that. But that's the point. We're living in difficult times, and we have to learn how to be practicing in difficult times. When I'm gone on some of these other retreats, that's when I think about Sims. All the time. I can't believe how much I compare us to everybody else, but that is comparing mine, and as I understand it, it's the last to go. Is that right, Tim? It's the last to go. So I'm like doing okay. But I think about us all the time. It's not so much comparing, are we as good as they are? It's not that. It's more of, all I think about is all the people in Seattle and in the area of Seattle who are having a difficult time. And how is it that we could open our arms up wide enough that there would be a sense of home here, that there would be a sense of, just because we're in uncertain times doesn't mean that we don't have the ability to look towards the sky. It doesn't mean that we don't have a lot of mudita. I was just at the New Year's Eve retreat at Spirit Rock, and we had this bubbling over of mudita. I don't know why, but for some reason, all the Dhamma talks, everything that, I mean, it was just this constant laughter in the room. And at the end of the retreat, which just ended on Sunday, yesterday, one of the yogis said, I have never realized how much joy helps us hold difficulty. That if someone had, she was saying that if someone had told her that in the midst of difficulty, she could think of some funny thing that was said the night before, burst into laughter, and not have to let go of the difficulty, she would not have believed it. she would have believed that when we're having difficulty, we're having difficulty. It's nose to the grindstone, let's get it done. That's the way we live in the regular world. But in Dhamma, it's not like that. All difficulty is held in the Brahmaviharas. So what Tim and I have been talking about is how can we strengthen Sims in such a way that we become interconnected with each other and we have a tight-knit net so that we feel strong during these difficult times. So whether you are here on a Monday night, or you're at a Sunday sit, or you're not here at all, you're at home, it doesn't matter where you are, if you're some other city, that you feel this sense of who we are, and we will do whatever it takes to make that happen. It means that if we have to help out to make sure financially we can do it, we're going to help out and make sure financially we can do it. If it means that we have to come and help out volunteering, then we're going to volunteer. It may be that I can only do one time, but we'll volunteer one time. I think that was all I was going to say. There's a way, I often think, someone told me that Seattle has 10,000 people moving here every month. I know you're thinking parking now, like, what? Where are these people going to drive? What? But there's a way in which the intention you take into a life is what your life becomes. So I'm hoping that this year, for the tens of thousands of people that come here, that we set this intention to allow Sims to become the Vipassana world here. That Buddha's message of generosity and love and joy and goodwill, kindness, becomes the marker in the city, that it transforms the whole world. And we find a way to make that happen. And I think if we set that intention, that's what's going to happen. So I'm going to end with one of my poems here called Wooden Boats, by Judy Sharon Brown. She says that, "I have a brother who builds wooden boats, who knows precisely how a board can bend or turn, steamed just exactly soft enough so he, with the help of his friends, can shape it to the hull." Think about that. I have a brother who builds wooden boats, like we have a Sangha who carries the Dhamma, who knows precisely how a board can bend or turn. We know how to deal with suffering. We know how to work through difficulties with skillful means. Who knows precisely how a board can bend or turn, steam just exactly soft enough so he, with the help of his friends, can shape it to the whole. And we, with the help of each other, can hold this world in these difficult times. The knowledge lies as much within his sure hands on the plane as in his head. It lies in love of wood and grain, a rough hand resting on the satin of the finished deck. Is there within each of us such artistry forgotten? in the cruder tasks the world requires of us, the faster modern work that we have turned our lives into, could we return to more of craft within our lives and feel the way the grain of wood runs true by letting our hands linger on the product of our artistry? Could we recall what we have known but have forgotten, the gifts within ourselves, each other too, and thus transform a world as he and his friends do, shaping steaming oak boards upon the hulls of wooden boats? So you just have to ask yourself, with this intention, is there something I could give, just some small thing I could give, to ensure that Sims stays this beacon of the Dhamma for all the people that are coming to Seattle, for all of us, and for this crazy, crazy world that we live in? Thank you. I was a little longer than 20 minutes.
You did fine.
He's so kind to me.
Easy to be kind to you, Twerry.
Nice.
All right, so it's always an interesting transition going from one topic to another. But moving us now toward the precepts of refuges, I just want to speak a little bit about these. Because in a little while we'll be taking those formally, doing some chanting, having some protection cords that we, for the old timers know, we do annually. This is only a simple ritual that we do, this chanting, this intentionality, that connects us with Buddhists all around the world. I mean, every day there's hundreds and hundreds of Buddhists who are saying these same words that we're going to say tonight. And in that way, that connection, I hope you feel that, not only present moment, but also all the way back for 2,600 years. This connection of intention, as Twerry was talking about. How do we come into this lineage and this realm of the Dharma? It's a reminder for those people who do it every day, a reminder of their commitment, of their intentionality, to help strengthen the times when things are difficult. Where do they go for that refuge? When we teach retreats, we often give the refuges at the beginning and the precepts at the beginning. You know, for many reasons. A couple reasons are to set the sense of container, that sense of intentionality, like we're all going in the same direction, toward liberation, toward releasing our suffering. So it helps to align the intention of all the group, people who may have come from a long distance, from a short distance. And so as we do that tonight, it's like bringing us from across the city and the geographic area of how far you may have traveled or how far you may be listening online, to align ourselves with this intentionality. This is what we value. This is why we're here. It also creates a structure of safety, of non-harm, that's so essential for us to be able to go into this territory that's often very tender, very sensitive. There's a way of opening up, letting go of our defenses, to be able to meet our hearts in a more pure, direct way, to learn to meet other people's hearts, and having a sense of shared integrity, a sense of shared non-harm, is very helpful. We can relax a bit. We can say, okay, this person sitting next to me, these people around me, are not going to harm me. It's an agreement to treat each other with kindness, with wisdom, with generosity. So we take these precepts and these refuges at the beginning of each year to help set that tone to carry through the whole year, to refresh this intention. So what are the refuges? To the Buddha, I go for refuge. To the Dharma, I go for refuge. And to the Sangha, I go for refuge. Now, this word refuge is so interesting. Tori was talking about how difficult the world is, how many things are falling apart, how many areas we look and we see things which are may seem to be getting worse and worse. We see that externally, we see that in our own lives perhaps, our own health, and we all have that those waves of pleasure and pain, of gain and loss, of health and illness, that we can't escape as human beings. A really interesting thing to notice about yourself is, where do you go for refuge in those times? Where do you seek relief and ease from that? Where do you seek shelter in the midst of those times? Those very personal areas of difficulty, the global areas of difficulty. Because our lives do fall apart at times, sometimes in small ways and sometimes in large ways. It could be as simple as not being able to find a parking spot. It could be as much more dire and devastating. Yeah, so we seek that place of escape, of relief, of support. We may have very functional, healthy ways of doing that, with self-care, getting good advice, getting support from trusted friends and family. Or we may have destructive ways of trying to find escape, of trying to find relief through addiction, through distraction, through harm. We take those solutions to the difficulty, we're taking refuge in our fear, in our anger, lashing out, taking refuge in our ideology, in our bias. And so tonight is about refreshing where our intention really lies, where we do take refuge. It can be very handy when in the midst of a difficult choice, a difficult experience, just to recall the refuges. They take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, to refresh your alignment with the precepts. And often that clarifies what is the choice that leads to less suffering. What's the choice that leads to freedom, to liberation? You know, what is the wise thing to do? What is the compassionate thing to do in this moment? This is in the very nitty-gritty of our lives. You know, not in the abstraction or isolation of just sitting quietly without any distractions. It's in the argument with the loved one, in the difficulty of what you hear on the politicians. And when you ask those questions, what is the wise thing? What is the compassionate thing? Where does that answer arise from? It arises from our practice. It arises from the access our practice gives us to our heart, to our wisdom. And it often comes in very mysterious ways. There's a clarity that can arise that seems so unattainable from our normal mind state. Even times when there's no obvious solution, no obvious way to go, having a sense of faith that, okay, well, still, I don't know what to do. Well, let's take this refuge. I go for refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. Now, the Buddha can represent, you know, a very real human being 2,600 years ago who had a deep, burning desire to understand the nature of his own suffering and the suffering of those around him. And he had insight so deeply, he was able to see through that suffering, through that quality of dependent origination, to see how that fell away. In its place, there was a stability. There's something that was beyond the worldly winds of gain and loss. And he taught that. He taught it, and it touched people in profound ways that this tradition has continued on for 2,600 years. So taking refuge in his courage, his wisdom to really challenge the assumption of his mind, to go through some very difficult experiences to be able to have his awakening. And what he teaches, what he taught, what is still alive today in sanghas like this all around the country, around the world, is this dharma, this understanding of how things actually are. That there's the very alive experience of that I think draws us into the practice. Perhaps we hear about it and we find it interesting. When we actually sit down and practice with it and we see it as a felt experience, it becomes alive in a way that is incomparable. It becomes so precious in our lives. And then finally, the Sangha. The Sangha, I mean, looking around, seeing all the like-minded people from the vast, you know, diversity, the vast range of life experience coming together under this one roof, this one intentionality to understand the Dharma. This is the refuge of the Sangha, that each one of you support each other in profound ways. Seeing the familiar faces, seeing the camaraderie along this path helps you walk the path even when it's difficult, even when we experience loss, we experience the suffering of life. So these three refuges of the Dharma, of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Now the five precepts, we can think of it actually as a more concrete expression of this going for refuge. You know, from this intentionality to how does the actual rubber hit the road? How do we actually act? How do we actually treat another person? Do we act from a basis of greed, of hatred, and delusion? Acting out in ways that harm in the various ways. Or we come from the deepest wisdom, deepest compassion that we have access to. And that way the precepts become naturally aligned in our actions, in our intention. Instead of acting from greed and hatred and delusion, we act from non-harm, from non-ill will, from renunciation. Now these five precepts, the Buddha said that these precepts, if we follow them, if we really take them seriously and really align our actions with them, they become immeasurable gifts for ourselves, and for all beings. There's the tangible way that people aren't harmed by your actions. There's a tangible way that your own mind and heart start to relax and open as you're not causing harm. And there's an intangible way of that echoing out through each being, unseen, unknown. I'm just going to say a few words about each of these five precepts. And as you listen, not only to my words, but also listen to your own response to those, our reactions, the ones that you get a little uncomfortable with, that you maybe blush a little bit like, oh, I kind of forgot about that one. The ones that feel a little edgy for you. And just make a note of that. That might be a place to practice more this coming year, to bring more energy, more interest, to see how does that precept really show up. I think ideally our relationship to precepts become more and more subtle. And they go from, okay, I'm not going to steal something, but to actually noticing how does that action take from people who are not even born yet? You know, how do my choice of what car I drive, what choices I do for transportation, how does that affect my children's children? And we go into that extension, that more subtle quality. How does the subtle qualities of harm might show up through my self-talk, my self-hatred that I often rehearse again and again. So the first precept is to undertake the training to refrain from killing. Refrain from harming, from killing other beings. This precept, you know, how often do we deny the right of another being to be alive, to have their own experience, to have their own view, their own emotions, their own reality? And we see that certainly maybe with insects. We just, okay, that insect does not even deserve to be alive. As you hear those words, you know, I feel that contraction in my heart. How often do I see another person and just disallow their very way of viewing the world? Is that not violent? is not a way of causing harm through my way of holding that person as being other than myself. I vow to cultivate compassion toward all beings. So we have, do we have these positive ones?
Mm-hmm.
So there's the positive elements of these also, of not only that we're refraining from, but how do we cultivate compassion toward all beings? The next precept is, I undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not freely given. That which is not freely given. You know, we all know, you know, people who are overly generous at the expense of their own. They won't, can't say no. And having that sense of maybe not asking them for something without really knowing if they're capable of giving it. Noticing how we take, there's this whole unconscious quality of taking up space, taking up airtime that, you know, I learned through some of my teacher training comrades, like especially being a white male, heterosexual, there's a way that my assumed privilege really asserts itself. Like, okay, I'm going to raise my hand, I'm going to speak out. And not realizing that by doing that, other people who are maybe more marginalized don't get a chance to speak. To learning that that's taking away what is not freely given. To maybe hold back a bit in that case and let others come forth. Experience with the subtle qualities of this. Certainly if we do have a trouble with stealing, of taking, to say, okay, how does that resonate in the heart? Always noticing how the heart has its own knowing, its own wisdom of whether this is appropriate or not. You know, feel, and sometimes it's hard. I was at a grocery store and someone left $5 in the change thing. I was like, $5? I could just put it in my pocket. You know, instead I said, okay, someone left this. You know, so that's renunciation, renunciating the short-term pleasure for the long-term peace. So I vow to practice generosity. The third precept is, I undertake the training to refrain from sexual harm. From sexual harm. And I vow to cultivate responsibility. So the sexual harm in this precept, and of course monastics take a vow of celibacy. On retreats we say abstaining from sexual actions. But in the lay life, you know, we are sexual beings. We interact with each other. It's a great source of delight. Not to mention, you know, children. You know, it's like that's a part of us being human. And yet we all know how much harm has been caused in the name of sexuality. You know, the Me Too movement is this really powerful way of starting to voice what has not been voiced for hundreds of years. So understanding how we use our sexuality, whether we're in a committed relationship or, you know, in a not in a relationship, how do we deal with our sexuality in a way that is first wise, that is first compassionate? Seeing the whole being. You know, how often are we trained to look at a particular movie star and see them as a sexual being instead of them as an actual human? To learn to see through that filter. That's part of that dependent origination, how we're trained to see a certain way instead of actually seeing the reality of that person. The fourth precept is, I undertake the training to refrain from harmful speech. From harmful speech and false speech. And certainly this... It would be nice if everyone in this country took that precept on. You know, and that sense of what is really true and what is really harmful, to understand that more and more deeply. I vow to cultivate loving speech and deep listening. This precept in particular is one of the edges for maybe the average practitioner, is learning how to really speak what's true. But also to notice, is it true and is it beneficial? Right? Those two things. It's like these two gates we have to go through. Third gate is whether it's the right timing. So it's not about just saying everything that you think is true. you should examine that for one. But also realize it has to have this beneficial quality. The Buddha set a very high bar for that, that speech leads to liberation. What about self-speech? How often do you tell things to yourself which are not completely true? Those common voices, oh, I'm such a failure, I'm such a idiot, whatever it might be, and how those too are harmful aspects of harm. They're not true. To refrain from harmful speech, speech which is not true. I vow to cultivate loving speech and deep listening. And the final precept is I undertake the training to refrain from intoxication, which leads to carelessness. The training to refrain from intoxication, which leads to carelessness. And this precept, in some ways, is one of the most important ones. Because as we become intoxicated, as we lose contact with how things actually are, all the precepts become much more easy to break. You know, I think, I don't know if there's anyone in this room or who's listening online, doesn't know someone personally who's caused great harm through intoxication, through heedlessness, whose lives haven't been touched in sometimes very traumatic and devastating ways. So in our particular way, we hold this, you know, we're not like abstinence. It's much more of a sense of what leads to that heedlessness, what leads to intoxication, you know, and knowing that for yourself. So it's, you know, having a glass of wine or something is fine. But maybe there's an edge for some of us of more than one glass. We start to become heedless. To holding that, you know, noticing that quality, noticing the pull of going toward pleasure, toward escape, be realizing that escape leads you to perhaps harming someone down the road. So I vow to ingest items that preserve peace, well-being, and joy. So these five precepts, combined with the three refuges, is an important container for our practice, an important intention that we bring into not only our Dharma practice, but every aspect of our lives. So may you take these precepts on as we chant them with Tori. Does everyone have a chanting sheet?
So does everybody have one?
I've got plenty.
Great. So you had an extra one? Okay.
So what we're going to do is infuse our own power within these cords. You know how sometimes we think we have to have the power of another to make something powerful, but we're going to infuse our own power through our own chanting. And I think the way we'll do this chanting is call and response. Let's see here. A couple things I want to tell you about, though. You will begin to see that the refuges, many of us know it, but it does have such a repeatable phrasing that even if you miss the first phrase, you'll be able to pick it up pretty quickly. When we get down to the, so we'll chant the Namo Tassa three times in a call and response. Then we'll chant the Pali version of the refuges, and then we'll chant the English version. And then the same with the precepts, we'll chant the Pali version and then the English version. In the precepts, we'll do the ending phrasing, which is basically, I undertake the training, that whole phrasing, we'll just do it all together in a call and response way. But like the refuges, it gets pretty repetitive, so you can kind of follow along. Namo tassa, namo tassa, bhagavato arahato, bhagavato arahato, samma sambuddhasa, samma sambuddhasa, namo tassa,
namo tassa,
bhagavato arahato, Samma Sambuddhasa,
Samma Sambuddhasa,
Namo Tassa,
Namo Tassa,
Bhagavato Arahato,
Bhagavato Arahato,
Samma Sambuddhasa,
Samma Sambuddhasa,
Buddham Saranam Gacchami,
Dhammam saranam gacchami,
Sangham saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi buddham saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Dutiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami. So together the English, to the Buddha I go for refuge. To the Dhamma, I go for refuge. To the Sangha, I go for refuge. For the second time, to the Buddha, I go for refuge. For the second time, to the Dhamma, I go for refuge. For the second time, to the Sangha, I go for refuge. For the third time, to the Buddha, I go for refuge. For the third time, to the Dhamma, I go for refuge. For the third time, to the Sangha I go for refuge. Panatipata, panatipata, brahmani sikapatam samadhiyami. Brahmani sikapatam samadhiyami. Adinadana, adinadana, brahmani sikapatam samadhiyami. Brahmani sikapatam samadhiyami. Kamesu, machachura, viramani sikapatam samadhiyami. Viramani sikapatam samadhiyami. Musawada, musawada, viramani sikapatam samadhiyami. Viramani sikapatam samadhiyami. Siramirya, siramirya, majapamadatana, majapamadatana, viramani sikapatam samadhiyami. Viramani sikapatam samadhiyami. And then the English? Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from killing. I vow to cultivate compassion towards all beings. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not freely given. I vow to practice generosity. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from sexual harm. I vow to cultivate responsibility. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from harmful speech. I vow to cultivate loving speech and deep listening. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from intoxication, which leads to carelessness. I vow to consume items that preserve peace, well-being, and joy. So now we can take these chords, and I like to put a knot for the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, a knot for the precepts, and a knot for whatever intention I'd like to set for this year to remind us. And then you can turn to your neighbor and have them put it on your wrist or your neck or your ankle, wherever. Or if you don't want it actually put on, you can actually just hold it and help them put theirs on. So we'll take a few minutes to do that. So we did want to save a little time to see if anybody had any comments or questions. So you're all ready for this year. We're in some serious times. Oh, there you go. I think for me, the reason why we shared what kinds of things are happening, so the beginning classes and the non-residentials and the weekly sits, is really to encourage each of us to think of what you could give in terms of your time. What could you over the course, if you think of 365 days over the course of the year, if everybody gave a little bit, then we could manage all of this that we have to do. The same way with Donna, given that we have to pay so much, it's thinking about how you give Donna, and do you only give if you come, and if you don't come, does that mean that Sims doesn't get the Donna? And so it's thinking more outside of the box in terms of how could I give and support Sims financially in a way that actually keeps us going. It's thinking like that. What could I do to ensure that Seattle Insight continues, whether I'm actually there or not? That's the way I wanted people to begin to think about who we are as an organization for all the people that would need Buddha's teachings on the awakened mind. What about you?
Yeah, so there's the very concrete things like registration table and helping out with volunteering. There's also ways of like social engagement. Like Iris has a nice board back there if you're drawn to engaging in that way. To how can I take my practice off the cushion? You know, whether it's showing up and helping set up chairs or cushions or doing something more like a registration or going in and helping out with some social activism. Mm-hmm. There's many opportunities. It's really taking from that kind of passive just receiving to how can I really be a participant in the Sangha and in the Dharma.
Yeah. Think of it in terms of what small thing can I do, and everybody does a small thing, and you'll be amazed at how much gets done. Think of it that way. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that.
I think what you're pointing to, Sue, this idea that here we are in this space and it's quiet and yet we feel so connected and yet we can hear the world outside with the traffic. It's something Eugene Cash said during one of his talks at this retreat, the paradox of Dhamma, and that paradox is what Buddha was pointing to. It's what Tim was saying, this idea. We have these preconceived ideas of what the world is, and that's what we get locked in, and that's what we think it is. But it is not that. And sometimes we can't see it unless we're with people who are actually trying to see through the film also, see through the delusion also. So here it is in this space, you actually could begin to feel that I could sit in a space where I don't even talk to someone and I feel so close to them. I can remember times when we were at, what's the first, Kingstone. And, you know, Rodney would turn the lights off before the sit even started. So the room was dark when you came in. Nobody's talking to nobody. He gave his Dhamma talk in silence. The whole thing was in silence. You left with the lights off. But there would be a sense in that room that you were safe, that you were held, and that it didn't matter what happened, we could take it on. That somehow that silence and that stillness and that being held together was so powerful and so moving that he would ring the bell and it would be the end of the sit and you're just sitting there, not moving, because there's a sense that we're all connected. We think we have to talk in order for that to happen, but we don't always have to talk in order for that to happen. So you're pointing to something very nice.
And also, what's really wonderful to realize is that that stillness, that interconnection, it seems like we have to learn it through the right environment, the right connections. But then we start to realize it's always there. We can walk out in the midst of all of the turbulence and noise, and there's still that stillness is still unaffected, no matter what the environment is. Mm-hmm. But we have to first be able to discover it, to realize it through the power of Sangha.
Yeah.
Right. Anyone else? Looks like we're about done.
Yeah. Good. Well, I hope I see you on a Monday night, or a Sunday morning, or whatever, Thursday, it's fine, wherever we go. If I don't see you, I don't know if I told you this, but you know that intensive course I did a couple of years ago? We are going to put that online, like a Canvas course that anybody can take and see how it goes. See how, if people could just take it at their own practice level, at their own practice decision rate and stuff, that if that works, we could put more classes online like that, because they actually have a free version of Canvas, and that we will be using. So we're going to try it this year and see how it is with the intensive course, and then see if that helps people who can't actually come to some of the classes. All right? Good. Something to look forward to. And we will see you around. Oh, the rideshares. Yeah. Do we have announcements?
I think the announcements where we have a beginning class starting next Thursday here, next Wednesday in the east side. Rodney Smith is doing a non-residential at Nalanda West.
Yeah.
On the next, not this weekend, but the weekend after. And
I think that's it.
That's the main thing.
Yeah.